Register Radio is sponsored by Ignatius Press, the premier publisher of outstanding Catholic books, magazines, videos, and music, faithful to the magisterium of the Church. On the web at ignatius.com.
From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
This week on Register Radio, Jeanette DeMello talks with Father C. John McCloskey about the recently announced beatification of Venerable Bishop Alvaro del Portillo. He is the successor of St. Jose Maria Escriva, the founder of Opus Dei. Also, Dan Burke talks with author Ann Carey about her recent book, Sisters in Crisis Revisited, which is a second updated edition of the book first published in 1997 that examines the dramatic changes in women's religious life since the Second Vatican Council. Welcome again to Register Radio. It's a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the Register. Hi, Jeanette.
Hello, Tom.
Hi there. Also, Dan Burke, executive director of the Register.
Great to be with you, Tom.
And with you, my friend. Our first guest today, Father C. John McCloskey, is a priest of Opus Dei. He is a church historian and research fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute in Washington, D.C. Fathers first encountered the man Opus Dei members called Don Alvaro while studying for the priesthood in Rome. Don Alvaro became the second leader of Opus Dei after the founder, St. Jose Maria Escriva, died in 1975. It was Pope John Paul II who ordained Don Alvaro, then the prelate of Opus Dei, a bishop in 1991. Bishop del Portillo died in 1994. Pope Benedict declared him venerable in July of 2012, and on July 5th, very recently, Pope Francis signed a decree approving a miracle that paves the way for now venerable Alvaro del Portillo's beatification. Father John, welcome back to Register Radio.
It's always a joy to be with you and your listeners.
Father McCloskey, it's been some time since we've had you on, but I'm excited to be talking to you today because this upcoming beatification has a special place in your life and all the members of Opus Dei. Now, St. Jose Maria Escriva was canonized in 2002. His successor, Don Alvaro, will be beatified soon, we hope, and what was the relationship between these two holy men?
It could not have been closer. Bishop Alvaro was probably among the first five or six people who joined Opus Dei in the late, well, actually in the early 1930s, right around the time of the Spanish Civil War. And he was considered as the right-hand man of St. Jose Maria until St. Jose Maria's death. So it's a very close relationship. From a historical viewpoint, I'm not aware of any time in the history of the Church where the founder of an institution of the Church, who was a saint, was founded, was later the person that he put in his place also was beatified and on his way to sainthood.
So what was Don Alvaro like? What was his personality? Can you tell us about the man?
Well, one thing I would say is he did not have a vivacious personality in the same way that St. Jose Maria had. In fact, your listeners can go on and look on YouTube and see small videos of both St. Jose Maria and also of Don Alvaro to see the contrast. After all, St. Jose Maria was a man into the arts, very much interested in law, because he also had studied law. But what you found in Don Alvaro was a person who was, an engineer. Along with a doctorate in engineering, he also had 3 degrees in canon law and in theology and so on. So he was very learned. And he also tended by nature. His temperament was more calm than St. Jose Maria. Maybe it had something to do from the different parts in Spain where they come from. But he was always in the background, with a perennial, at least as I remember him personally, smile on his face that was not something that was false. It was something that flew from the inner peace that he had in him, and that he saw his role as the closest follower of St. Jose Maria as basically to be faithful to the spirit of Opus Dei that St. Jose Maria had seen, and always to be in the background serving God in the Church and the work of Opus Dei in the way that God wanted it to be.
And you mentioned just a moment ago that you did have personal interaction with Don Portillo. Can you tell us about that personal interaction?
Yes. Well, I was there at a very interesting time in Rome, 78 to 80, during the time of the death of Luciani, the election of John Paul. Very interesting time, not only for the church, but also for Opus Dei, because Opus Dei was very interested as from the very beginning, and it took literally decades in order to find its proper place inside of the church, which was a novelty that they were introducing into canon law. And my own, let's say, interaction with Don Alvaro was fairly simple, is that he would have what we call family get-togethers or meetings with members of Opus Dei, both single and priest, and particularly those people who were studying at the Roman College of the Holy Cross, who the great majority of whom would go on to become priest of the prelature. So we would meet him with him, I'd say, not as much as we would have liked because precisely of the new pope and also the things that were going on in terms to get the final approbation of Opus Dei. But I did have a chance to see him, as they say, up close and personal on a couple occasions. One occasion that really sticks out, obviously, is that I had the opportunity at some point to just talk with him a little bit in terms of expressing my willingness and my availability to be ordained as a priest of the prelature if he and the needs of Opus Dei were that way. And what I found very impressive about him is here I was a nobody young man, just over from the United States, not too many months and years, and he took the time to walk back and forth with me, listening to me, talking to me, asking me questions, even though I know he had an important date at the Vatican that he was supposed to go to with a car running and so on. And that showed me the warmth and the understanding that what he considered most important of all were the persons that he was responsible for, much more important even than his work in the Vatican.
This is Jeanette DiMello with Register Radio. I'm speaking with Father C. John McCloskey, and we're talking about Don Alvaro Portillo, who will be beatified soon. It's an amazing thing that the successor to St. Jose Maria is now on his way to beatification, as we talked about at the beginning. But can you tell us exactly what Opus Dei sees as his profound contribution to the work and to the church?
Well, I think it's twofold. One is his faithfulness to his own vocation, right from the beginning and right to the end, which is a good thing for any of us. And it has to do also with not priests or nuns alone, but obviously to people in their marriages and all types of relationships and our faithfulness to the church. I think that was very, very important. However, there was another thing there that, of course, any institution of the church should be there precisely in order to serve the church the way the church wants. And so while Don Alvaro was not only, you could almost say, a second founder in a certain sense of Opus Dei, nonetheless, he spent a lot of his time helping the church. That is, he was very involved in the Vatican and various, in what they call it, dicasteries or congregations. And he was very well known as being expert in that way and was called again and again in order to help right up until the end, until he died. When Don Alvaro died, which was a very poignant moment, the day before he had been in the Holy Land celebrating his 80th birthday, and he had celebrated Mass in the cenacle where our Lord instituted the Eucharist. He came back, and he died that night, which is also something probably has never happened in history. When he died, of course, it was reported to John Paul, and with the very next day, when Don Alvaro was being waked and laid in state, so to speak, in the Church of Opus Dei in Rome, with which I know you're familiar, the Pope came with one of his cardinals, and it was the only time in the pontificate of John Paul II that he actually got into a car, went to the wake, wrote his name down, and prayed for a half an hour before Don Alvaro. That's how close the relationship was.
It's really remarkable. And can you tell us how Pope John Paul and Don Alvaro met? I know they had a long history.
Well, the history is interesting. It goes back to the Second Vatican Council. Don Alvaro was a periti. He was an expert in terms of helping in the council. And of course, that's where, even to this day, lots of the people who were in that council, that they, their first encounter with other popes. You know, there were five different popes who were present during that council or participated. I mean, the future popes, I should say. So it's a remarkable thing. So that was, I think, Wojtyła's first contact with Opus Dei. And then when he was elected pope, of course, he knew about Opus Dei. And only 2 weeks before he went into that conclave, he went in order to pray at the tomb of St. Jose Maria. He was accompanied there by Don Alvaro.
This is Jeanette DeMello with Register Radio. I'm speaking with Father C. John McCloskey, and we're talking about the upcoming beatification of Don Alvaro Portillo. Now, Father McCloskey, do you know anything about the miracle that has helped to pave the way to the beatification of Don Alvaro?
Yes, it's the first thing that probably should be said is there was almost 2,000 different favors that had been reported before, including ones that could have been used besides this one. But this one had to do with the cure of a baby who was, the doctors had given up on altogether, that was being, in the process of being born, it was born, whose heart had stopped and so on. The family around the baby prayed to Don Alvaro that the baby be saved, and all of a sudden the heart started beating again. There was no explanation whatsoever from a medical viewpoint for that happening.
Wow, it really teaches us to have faith and to ask for miracles with a faith that believes. I'm really appreciative for these kinds of stories. You know, I have my own appreciation of Don Alvaro because he founded Santa Croce, Holy Cross, the college that you went to and many years later the college that I received my graduate degree from. So I'm most grateful for his contribution there.
It was Pope John Paul who asked him to start that particular university, as if Rome didn't have enough Roman universities. But he thought that Opus Dei's spirit, its secularity, would be a help, and also it could develop precisely programs like you attended and many other people in areas that the other pontifical universities, good as they are, did not have. He asked Don Alvaro to think about it. And so Don Alvaro did, and then their next meeting was a year later, and the Pope said to him, "Have you started the university already?"
he meant action, right?
that's when he knew that the Pope was serious about this, and it was a great burden and continues to be a burden, one that's lovable, in order to put together from scratch, and I will not say in competition with the others, because that's not the way we look at it. But, you know, a lot of those universities have been in existence 600 years.
Sure, in complement to the others. Well, McCloskey, we're so grateful that you were on today, and we look forward to more of you at the Register.
Well, thank you very much. It's always good, and you know how close I am to the Register and to EWTN.
Thank you, Father.
Hello, I'm Michael Warsaw, Chief Executive of EWTN and publisher of the National Catholic Register. We're in a time in history like no other, and our fight for religious freedom and the need for the new evangelization, it's essential to stay connected via the faithful Catholic content delivered by the Register. We've finally been able to help realize Mother Angelica's dream. She always wanted a newspaper as part of EWTN's media apostolate. Why? Because there's an important catechetical opportunity at the intersection of faith and culture. Since the 1920s, the Register has been advancing the truth of the Magisterium. This valuable resource will help you to better understand the faith and deepen your relationship with our Lord. Join the growing ranks of Register subscribers today and access the one source of leading voices and opinions concerning the issues that matter most to you.
To start your subscription to the National Catholic Register today, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register or call 800-854-6316. That's EWTN.com and click on the Register subscription banner or call 800-854-6316.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. Along with Jeanette DeMello and Dan Burke, I'm Tom Price. Our next guest is Ann Carey. She has written extensively about Catholic women religious for many years, publishing articles on the subject in the National Catholic Register, Our Sunday Visitor, Crisis, and Catholic World Report. She has received Catholic Press Association awards for news and feature writing and for investigative reporting. The second, updated edition of her very important book, Sisters in Crisis, is now available from Ignatius Press. It discusses at length the ongoing controversy surrounding the Leadership Conference of Women Religious and that group's clashes with the Vatican. The book also examines the dramatic changes in the lives of women religious in the United States in the years since Vatican II, as well as the increasingly hopeful signs of genuine renewal which are cropping up in religious communities across the country. And welcome back to Register Radio.
Thank you.
I'm a huge fan of your work, your writing, particularly I read every word of the first edition of your book, many ways because I think that it provides insight into the health of the church, the challenges of the church as a whole, but focused specifically on how these challenges have affected women religious in America. And you finished your book in 96. It was published in 97. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
What would you say about the situation since then, since the publishing of that book? Are things getting worse or better? Give us an overview of what's happening in women religious communities.
Well, I think things are getting better, considerably better, in those 17 years now since I wrote the book, because so many of the newer orders of women religious that were founded on that classic model of religious life, of living and praying in community and close ties with the church and having a corporate apostolate that's exercised in the name of the church, so many of those younger communities are doing very well in attracting vocations and are making a considerable impression on the church here through their various ministries. But also some of the older established orders that have embraced that classic model of religious life all along, and the Nashville Dominican certainly come to mind when I think of that model, the Alton Franciscans in Illinois. But anyway, those orders of sisters are doing very, very well. And I kind of knew that when the first book came out in 97 because things were looking good for them. But in the past 16 years, several surveys have been done by important centers like the Center for Applied Research and the Apostolate of Georgetown that show that those orders are the ones that are attracting the young people to join because they are so distinctly Catholic and so distinctly religious life. They're practicing religious life as the church understands it. So things are looking much better, I think, because of that.
So, Anne, if you could give us a quick snapshot comparison of those orders that are dying out that seem to be, I think I can call, extreme confusion with respect to who is Christ, what is the church, what is their role, versus Nashville Dominicans, Mother Assumpta's order. What are the central contrasts between the beliefs and understandings of these two groups that have led to the demise of one and the rise of the other?
You know, I think part of the problem is with so many of these, I call them the change-oriented groups, is that they've kind of changed the focus of religious life from having an ecclesial focus to more of a sociological focus. Many of these members of these orders are certainly doing good works, but they're not doing them in the name of the church, and they're not necessarily, you know, affiliated with the church in any way. Some of them have moved to what they call liberating oppressed peoples, and many of them have an agenda of saving the earth, which are certainly fine agenda, but it's not the ecclesial relationship and agenda that the church has always understood religious life to have. And in these change-oriented orders, many of the sisters have started living on their own rather than living in community and having individual prayer rather than that community life and prayer together that bonds the sisters and enables them in their apostolate. So those, I think, are some of the big contrasts between those orders. But one other problem is that some of those change-oriented orders also have drifted a bit from Catholic doctrine and some of the Catholic teachings, particularly in regard to human sexuality, women's ordination ministry to the homosexual community. And that has brought them into doctrinal conflict with the church.
This is Dan Burke with Register Radio, and we're speaking with Ann Carey, the author of Sisters in Crisis, the best work that covers the challenges of women religious in the church today, and also provides profound insight into understanding where the healthy life of the church is and where things are in great need of redemption. Now, Ann, you're a very charitable person. I'm going to give you my juxtaposition of the issues between these two groups, and let's maybe juxtapose the LCWR and the CMSWR. But essentially, the LCWR, as I read it from a person who's involved with mystical and ascetical theology very much, has left Christ or redefined Christ as this cosmic force or principle, or as this, you know, something I see in others. Whereas the traditional groups have retained the understanding of who Christ revealed himself to be, which is our God, our friend, our greatest love, the source from which all of our Catholic life flows. So that if we pursue feeding the poor and mitigating sociological ills or political ills, we pursue it in a way that is animated by our personal relationship with Christ himself, versus an agenda that's really animated by a very confused anthropology, a very confused theology that really is becoming much more New Age. And I think even in the speaker in their upcoming conference in August, even though she's a sister this time and not Barbara Marx Hubbard, you could easily swap them out. You know, this sister says that sin is a disconnectedness from the universe, that we need to, she implies that we need to work towards this non-dual consciousness, which means that, I am not, God and I are the same thing, basically,
wow.
Rather than distinct. I mean, at the heart of this problem is a loss of faith. So argue with me, Ann. Tell me I'm being uncharitable.
No, I'm sorry. I would have to agree with you totally, Dan, but with one caveat, and that is that not all of the sisters whose superiors belong to the LCWR share that particular philosophy. We have to remember that the Leadership Conference of Women Religious is just 1,300 sisters, and they are members of leadership teams of about 80% of the sisters in this country. And how they got into leadership positions is another story altogether that we can save for another day.
When you cover that very well in your book, and so let me reiterate this because it is important. I spent some time recently speaking at the Institute on Religious Life, and I met some wonderful sisters who are in the LCWR bucket, if you will, who are absolutely faithful to the magisterium, love the Lord with all their heart, and are giving their lives away to this very day, but they're stuck in the context of this leadership that disagrees with them, that suppresses them, that makes their life and living in the call to which God brought them
stuck
very,
a,
very difficult.
Stuck is a good word here.
I agree with you totally. You know, I hear from those sisters all the time, and they say, Ann, please tell people that these leaders who are disagreeing with the church's doctrines and degrading the bishops and the hierarchy, please tell people we don't agree with them.
You know, I had a religious order recently that I was talking with that said that after the visitation and a little bit of the stir, realized they needed to let their own constituency know that they are committed to the church and to the magisterium and do not feel suppressed. So they started a whole web and Facebook initiative just to say, hey, the media's got this wrong. We love the Lord. We love the church. We are not oppressed. We are liberated. We're doing what God has for us to do, and they're very excited. And by the way, they're part of one of the growing orders in the church.
You know, I think it's incumbent upon those of us in the Catholic media to let people know that these sisters are out there and that these sisters who are making all this noise in the media do not represent most religious women. So that would be my caveat, that how you have described the leadership of the Leadership Conference is accurate, but they don't represent all the sisters in their orders.
And another thought I've had, and I wonder if you think, again, this may be a bit too harsh. I mean, a lot of us give money to these orders. If you ask me where to give your money, I'm going to give to those that are associated with the Council of major superiors of women religious, which are committed to the magisterium of the church, and they can be found at cmswr.org, rather than giving to those orders that tend to tear down the faith. But I've struggled with that too, because you know, there are good sisters in those, in the LCWR orders.
Right, and sometimes you can donate your funds in a certain way that it goes only to them. But you do have to be careful, because some of the sisters that in the orders that are seem to be in the most dire financial needs are spending their money in very strange ways. I mean, some of them have converted some of their properties to certainly non-ecclesial efforts that would not be in conformity with the Catholic Church. So one does have to be very, very careful. And also, Dan, I think we need to clarify just what the Council of Major Superiors of Women Religious is. It is another superiors organization equal to the same pontifical status as the Leadership Conference, but it is of these more classic orders of religious life that are following that classic model. And about 20% of the sisters in the United States are represented by that Council of Major Superiors of Women Religious. And they, by the way, are getting most of the new vocations.
Exactly. So if you're going to give to the LCWR, I think my advice would be dig in, find out where the money is going, and designate it to those things that are actually building up the church and in keeping with the church. If you want to give to orders that are not having these challenges, the cmswr.org is the place to go. Now, Ann, let's wrap up by telling folks about your latest book. Give us a quick update on what you cover, and folks can find it at EWTN Religious Catalog, and we'll certainly have you back on after the conference in August to talk about this again, too.
Yes, the new edition covers the last 16 years or 17 years that were not covered in the previous book, and that includes the assessment, the doctrinal assessment of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious that is ongoing, and the apostolic visitation of all U.S. women's religious orders that occurred between 2009 and 2011. We're still waiting to hear some feedback on that, but it covers all those important details and updates the last 17 years.
Your first book ended on a grim note. This one ends on a very encouraging note, because it covers some of what we discussed today, the new springtime of the faith as it's rising in and among those sisters who are fully embracing Christ and the magisterium of the church.
That's right, and now we have the empirical data from all those studies to prove that that's what's happening.
And it's always a delight to talk with you. Thank you so much for all that you do for the church.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks again for joining us on Register Radio this week. For all of us at the Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Register Radio is sponsored by Ignatius Press, the premier publisher of outstanding Catholic books, magazines, videos, and music, faithful to the magisterium of the Church. On the web at ignatius.com.